Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Jane. I know that Don might be in between calls. Don, I see you on the line, but I have to set up the introduction to the show. So we're going to discuss three things tonight. What ultimately makes us happy, and I will be talking about my favorite Netflix series. John's going to be interjecting about his music after quarter after. Right now he's tied up for 10 minutes. And I'm going to tie in the new year into what happened 20 years ago with Bill Clinton in 1991, 92 when he took office, and George W. Bush, and how ISIS has ultimately changed the world. I'm going to read a short clip, Don. By the beginning of the last decade of the 20th century, Wilsonianism, a.k.a. isolationism, seemed triumphant. The communists, well, Wilson also advocated for the League of Nations, the first international body of cooperation. The communist ideological and the Soviet geopolitical challenges had overcome simultaneously. The objective of moral opposition to communism had merged with the geopolitical task of resisting Soviet expansionism. No wonder that President George Herbert Walker Bush proclaimed his hope for a new world order in classic Wilsonian terms. We have a vision of a new partnership of nations that transcends the Cold War, a partnership based on consultation, cooperation, and collective action, especially through international and regional organizations. A partnership united by principle and the rule of law and supported by an equitable sharing of both cost and commitment. A partnership whose goals are to increase democracy, increase prosperity, increase peace, and reduce arms. Now, in a minute, we will talk about what was accomplished and what wasn't. In the same vein, President Clinton said when he took office in early 1993, "In a new era of peril and opportunity, our overriding purpose must be to expand and strengthen the world community of market-based democracies. During the Cold War, we sought to contain a threat to survival of free institutions. Now we seek to enlarge the circle of nations that live under those free institutions for our dream. Is a day when the opinions and the energies of every person in the world will be given full expression in a world of thriving democracies that cooperate with each other and live in peace." Now, I just want to make one quick commentary out of Kissinger. This is his book called Diplomacy. It's the last chapter. Both Bush and Clinton spoke of the New World Order as if it were just around the corner. In fact, it is still a period of gestation, and its final form will not be visible until well into the next century. Part extension of the past, part unprecedented, the New World Order, like those which it succeeds, will emerge as an answer to three questions. What are the basic units of international order? What are their means of interacting? What are the goals on behalf of which they interact? International systems live precariously. Every world order expresses an aspiration to permanence. The very term has a ring of eternity about it. Yet the elements which comprise it are in a constant flux. Indeed, with each century, the duration of international systems has been shrinking. The order that grew out of the Peace of Westphalia, after the 30 Years' War, mind you, in 1648, lasted 150 years. The international system created by the Congress of Vienna maintains itself for 100 years. The international order characterized by the Cold War ended 40 years. Never before has the components of world order, their capacity to interact, and their goals all changed quite so rapidly, so deeply, or so globally. No, I just have one more comment before I bring Don in. When Kissinger wrote this book in the mid-90s, he didn't understand the impact of social media and the internet, nor could he, because it wasn't around. It didn't really take a boom till 1996. And secondly, there was no creation at that time of significant world actors of ISIS, who are non-territorial warring factions that possess no territory but invade many countries. So with that, I'll bring Don in. Good evening, Don. Good evening, Don Gallimore. Don, you need to respond. Okay, I'm putting you on mute. What I'm going to do is I'm going to play a clip of the New World Order. Bear with me a minute while I find it. In the meantime, Don Gallimore, I will have to cut you off if you're not being alert. Don, are you there? You're off mute now. Well, let's just do this thing quick. You know, we are talking about a new world order, but strangely enough, when you really look back to 1989 when the Russian curtain fell, there were countries like Tajikistan that got their independence, but a lot of it has not changed. I hate to inform you all. The new world order has not fully changed. Why? Because Russia is still a territorial expansionist, and they still have the same grappling interests that they did back when they had it in the other days, the days when they tried to dominate the Black Sea and Mediterranean area, when they dominated northern Iraq. Not that much has changed. So I was trying to get to another video, but what I'll do is I'll look for one. One second.
1945 and the end of the war through 1989 and the end of the Cold War, we had a worldview. Republican and Democratic presidents alike, from Harry Truman to George Bush, stood for freedom and stood for certain propositions that would make America strong and healthy and grow the middle class and shrink poverty and stand against communism. And after 1989, President Bush said, and it's a phrase that I often use myself, that we needed a new world order. And instead, it looks like we got a lot of disorder. We still, and after 9/11, we've been more sensitive.
Okay, we are going to cut back to, we're going to cut back to John's song, and then I'm going to try to find out what happened to my host.
Thank you.
Good evening, John. How are you doing tonight?
Greetings from California.
Are you in a parking lot, a house, or in a shopping cart?
I'm actually in a line at the store. However, earlier I had mentioned I was calling a friend's phone. They were trying to find it, and they did. So one problem at a time we're solving.
Well, that's why I gave you 10 minutes leeway. Now, Dumb Don in a smartphone called in, but yet I couldn't get his voice to talk, so I hung up on him and text him to call back in and talk.
Well, so it sounds like his old school phone was working a lot better than his smartphone.
Well, maybe I should have kept Albert because he's 58 and he can't figure it out 2 weeks in a row.
Yes,
but,
Albert
is
dedicated.
I'll try to keep it positive tonight. Let's spend the first 10 minutes talking about your new remastered song that we just played, only you retitled it for the video only once. And
yes.
I'm assuming only once in a lifetime is what it implied. Am I correct?
Yes, basically the idea of marriage and commitment is a one-time thing. Like, you do it and you just figure it out until you die. Like, you know, I think the reason why God set it up to be that way was it's too easy to have a reason to, you know, to leave. Like, you know, there's 100 things that could go wrong. Oh, my wife has cancer. Oh, he has a prostate problem. We can't have sexual relations. Oh, he snores when he sleeps. Oh, she has, you know, these kids and they're too much trouble. There's always a reason to leave. And I think if you go into marriage with just this thought, this is something that I thought we had resolved in the first year, you know, the first 6 months, I dated like 3.5 years. So I pretty much was resolved, like, okay, this is really what I wanted to do. But even with all the time that we dated and tried to work through things, after we got married, the first couple months was like, why did I do this? I don't have to be married. You know, I mean, we would throw out lines and jabs at each other. And after about 3 or 4 months, we finally just came to this decision. It's like, divorce is not to be discussed. It's just not to, you know, it's not part of the program. It's just too many easy reasons to not be married. And we just decided we're just going to work through anything. And we did.
By the way, I do want to question you on that. Don did call in. I just had to acknowledge that because I was having trouble hearing him. I agree with all your premises, but in reality, things go wrong. My child died, and I wasn't half as dedicated as you were, and my marriage ended with even a very committed partner. So in reality, what's on paper isn't always going to work out on reality.
Well, I don't buy into it. In other words, if you put a gun to someone's head and said, you can't leave, you'd be like, okay, I can work this out. You know, I think there's very few instances, unless someone's like really unfaithful and they just can't control themselves. You know, that obviously if you commit adultery, that's a reason for divorce. But I'm just saying there's always a reason. It's never convenient. It's like having kids. Think of it like when you had your son. Is there any reason why you would ditch him the first 10 years of his life? Even if it wasn't convenient, even if it wasn't fun?
Only if
diet?
I was out of my mind and a drug addict.
There you go.
Well, my question to you is this, and to tell you the truth, when I watched the video, I liked it, but I got really sad because it's a very moving song. And then when I saw how you retitled it, I even got sadder because, see, I know why my marriage ended, and I don't dwell on it anymore because Craig and I weren't that 100% connected to begin with. But the thing is Even if that's your absolute ideal, like no divorce ever, when it ultimately happens, then you have to deal with it and move on, right?
Oh yeah, and see, part of it is it's this concept that it's just not an option to pursue. Like we're just going to work through whatever, and when things happen, you can't control the other person, obviously. So you have to move forward. But just kind of in my mind, I just felt that if both people are committed that way, there's nothing that can stop you. And if you're not committed 100%, there's always going to be something that comes up that it just becomes too it's just easy to let go. Yeah.
Well, yours lasted 15 years, and I'm glad, you know, that God blessed you with that longevity. But in the end, she made an impulsive decision to leave, so there's nothing you really can do about it.
No, and that's what's kind of destroyed our culture, is that we came up with this whole – before, you had that commitment, and it's like people were just going to work through it. And the only way out was if the person committed adultery, and it had to be proven. You know, you had to go to court and actually prove, here's pictures or here's evidence. And it's not like that anymore. Now people just say, irreconcilable differences. I'm unhappy. And there's nothing the other person can do. You can't stop it. You can't. So it becomes, for men, a terrible business deal. It's like, why commit to...
Well, in most states, it's a no-fault divorce, like you mentioned. I know, I think I heard of a story one time where, I'm going to bring Dawn in. I heard of a story one time where someone wouldn't allow a divorce, and the process lasted for like a year. I can't remember who or what state it was, but it was dragged out.
Let's bring Dawn in
to get some clarification, being the fact that he's been married 30 years. Hi, Dawn. Don Gallagher.
Yeah, hi there, guys. Hey, good evening.
Yeah,
guys.
John wanted to say one more thing. Are you Uber driving still?
I'm done for the night. We're flooding here, and it's getting pretty bad. I went through. Luckily, I have a Prius, which is all electric. And then I went through a big old puddle that two cars were stuck in. Went through that up to the doors, and it went through successfully. So I've already gone through my work of fire.
So in other words, the snow turned into rain, and then the rain turned into puddles, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, these aren't puddles. But yeah, I went through probably the biggest one here in Reno. But we've got it. It's not too bad. It's not as bad as 97, 2000, and 2005. But it's significant, and we haven't crested yet. We aren't expected to crest until about 4 o'clock tomorrow morning. But we're in it, and I've been out here all day having a great time. I'm from Wisconsin, so I've been out the last 3 days in the with the icy roads, and I've been having a great time.
Sounds good to you. So John was trying to make a point about commitment and marriage. Oh, we do have a caller from the 612. I did advertise that people want to say their favorite Netflix show. John, can you hold that thought a minute while I bring in the guest?
Go for it.
Well, we can, but then it's going to be another 15 because I got to get out of this place and do some things. But let me just state my last case, and that is that marriage is a vow to God. So let me repeat that. It's a promise to God if you really respect it. If you can, don't make a promise to God unless you're going to keep it. There's no reason to break a promise to God. And if so, change your wedding vows. Like, okay, as long as things are cool and it's easy and it's fun together, and the minute there's a problem in our relationships, we both agree to just drop it because it's just inconvenient. I think people should read those kind of vows, but don't say, I found my soulmate and I promised to God to make this work for better or for worse, because people aren't going into that. It's a lie. And I just think people just don't respect it. They don't make an honest promise. You make a old school promises. You make it happen, or you die. I mean, that's just where you know when you promise something. That's how I was raised, and we lost that. So
Well, John, you were supposed to comment on your music tonight, so it's a little too early to bail. But I definitely want to hear what this. What, Don?
I'm sad to see you go, John, so early. I'm sorry I was late, but I'm sad to see you go because, for the most part, this is a subject.
No, I will still be with you. I'm just saying I'm in a grocery line, so I need to not talk for about 5 minutes and go home and set up things. So I'm still with the show. I'm just saying that the longer I wait without commenting, then I'm stuck here in a corner of a grocery store. But you can continue, and I'm listening.
Okay, what I'll do is if you need to hang up, you can call back, please. And I'm going to take this caller.
Oh, go for it. I'm still here.
This is Jane from Blog Talk Radio. Who's calling in, please?
Yeah, good evening. My name is Michael. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good.
So we were talking about the New World Order before Don could actually talk, even though he was listening. Then we were talking about a newly released song by my co-host, and then somehow we got on the subject of marriage, but part of the show tonight entails Netflix shows and the future of our democracy. So what subject would you like to touch on tonight?
Just 2 points, I guess. First is about what makes you happy, and then secondly would be about the political situation in America.
Sure. Go ahead and share your view.
Yeah, I think the first one, I would assume all of us on the line are Christians, right?
I'm a Christian. Yeah, we all are Christians. Probably at different levels of perfection, but we're all Christians.
Okay. And you might have heard this analogy before, but I think it's really, I think it's great for putting, you know, life in perspective. And it goes like this. It's like, if you view Christianity and your salvation, let's use it as a parachute. Let's say you're on an airplane, and the airplane symbolizes life, and you're sitting on the airplane, and you could be one of two people and how you view your salvation. The first person, let's say the hostess comes in and gives him a parachute and tells him that the parachute is going to make his flight nice and comfortable and allow him to have an enjoyable flight. And then the second man is told that to wear this parachute basically because the plane in about an hour is going to explode and he's going to have to jump from 30,000 feet, and the parachute is the only thing that's going to save his life. Now, these two men sit on the airplane riding together. They both get a hot cup of coffee. They hit some turbulence, and the coffee spills on both of their laps. Now, the man who was told that the parachute is going to make his flight better, he gets upset because the parachute didn't help him, and he's feeling the pain of the burn. The second man, while he's feeling the same pain and burn, he's not as necessarily taking it as bad or the wrong way, because he's more concerned about the fact that this plane is going to explode in an hour. And he's still happy about the fact that the parachute is the only thing that's going to save his life. Now, as the flight goes on, some of the other people on the plane start noticing that there's these two guys wearing parachutes, and they start making fun of them. The guy who was told that the parachute is going to make his flight better, he starts getting uncomfortable, starts feeling bad because other people are making fun of him, putting him down for wearing a parachute. And now he starts to get bitter and upset about the very parachute that he's wearing, to the point where he says, forget it. He takes the parachute off, throws it down, and doesn't want anything to do with it anymore. Because as far as he's concerned, it didn't help his flight, and all it did is it didn't prevent him from pain, and people were making fun of him and ridiculing him. So he gets rid of it.
Yes.
The second man, right, who's wearing it, he still hears all the same insults from everybody, but at the end of the day, he doesn't let that bother him because he's still more focused on the fact that he knows the plane is going to explode in an hour and that the parachute is the only thing there to save his life. And so the reason I brought up that analogy is that's a two different type of Christian. The Christian who approaches
so
his salvation
thinking. So is the parachute
a
security blanket that's supposed to represent eternal life with Christ?
Yeah, so it's supposed to represent how you view your relationship to Jesus. Like, a lot of people, for example, they look at it like, well, Jesus is here to make me happy, make me rich, make me healthy, give me all the good things in life that make me feel good. And that's what a lot of people approach Christianity like today, especially in like the last 10 years in America.
It's called prosperity preaching, like Joel Osteen.
Exactly.
But, can I make a quick comment? Don,
yeah, go ahead.
Your background noise is a little noisy, so I'm going to put you on mute for 60 seconds. The only thing I have to say about that is watching the whole scenario with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump lay out. And then on one hand, we have a secular advocate named Hillary, who I was a strong Clinton supporter for 25 years. And, like, for example, she supports gays and gay rights, but the Bible is contradictory to that. But she kind of has, like, this inclusive outcome where, you know, everybody belongs, yada, yada, yada. And then I watched Donald Trump with his negative, sharp-tongued speech, where on one hand he was not mincing words, he was severely insulting his opponents, yet on the other hand, out of the other side of his mouth, he was making promises of greatness, and but yet he had exhibited no intelligence about government. So at the end of the day, Jesus is still coming back. What's said in Matthew 24 is still going to take place. There's still going to be changes in the sun, moon, and stars. The environment's still going to take place. There's going to be a showdown in Jerusalem between major world powers. So whether I have the security of Christ, which I know I do, or I'm going to get attacked by someone in an airplane tomorrow, I'm not really scared because I know in the end that Jesus is coming back and my life on earth is mortal and I'm going to die one way or another. It might be suddenly or slowly, so I'm not afraid. So I agree with what you were saying, and I have never heard the parachute analogy before. The only thing I'd probably change in the story is that sometimes our life is long and we have many 5 to 10 year trials, and our life isn't going to end tragically in an hour. Sometimes we think it might end sooner or we might get redeemed sooner, but the trial seems to get longer and longer. So is there anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think the perfect passage, I think it's in Hebrews where it said that when Jesus endured the whole crucifixion process, that it talked about how he kept his focus on the joy before him, which allowed him to endure the pain and the shame and all the different things that happened to him. And I think that's why it goes on to tell us that we should practice the same form of patience, that no matter what happens now, to have your mindset thinking on the joy in front of you. Like when Stephen was getting stoned and they were stoning him to death, he looked to heaven and he saw Jesus standing at the right hand of the Father. And because he had that heavenly perspective, it kind of allowed him to forgive the people that were killing him, because he kept his mind on the joy that was about to happen to him, you know, the joy of knowing he was going to be with the
right.
Lord. So.
And Jesus, because he was part of the Holy Trinity, probably he had more of a greater perception than just an average human. He obviously knew, you know, what his purpose on earth was. They said that the entity of Jesus existed at the beginning of time, so his level of comprehension is even beyond ours. John, did you want to make a comment on this?
Yeah, I love the analogy, and I have to tell you, you know, I think it's true, and I also think it transcends, there's another level to this. In other words, earlier in my Christian life, and at times, yes, salvation has been this, like, parachute of, like, when it all crashes and burns and you get to the end of your life and you die and, you know, heaven or hell kind of thing, I know I'm doubling down on heaven. So there's a security in that. But in the meantime, there was kind of this feeling like my life is kind of gets messed up because I'm trying to be moral in an immoral world. I'm trying to be nice and be fair and cool in a place where people are stealing and killing and manipulating. And in the short term, it seems like I'm really missing out on some things. You know, I'm not as materialistic. But in the big picture, kind of going forward, you know, without Christianity or without a moral spiritual base, this life, it just doesn't work. Like, there's always this battle that people have. They're just trying to manipulate each other. And the conclusion I come to is 3% rule and they're elite. And the rest of us, you have some middle class, but the rest of us are peasants. And the only way you're going to even things out for the rest of the losers is revolt. It's taking down the rich guy or the manipulative guy or that boss at work that's just such a jerk that, you know, rubs it in your face every day. And you get to this level, like, the only way I'm going to get hit is take some people out, you know, whether physically or whether by you know, financially or by manipulating them. And it's like, that's a dark, evil way to live. And even the song I was talking about, Only Once, if my wife had kept the perspective, we made a vow to God, you know, we would still be together. We'd have a family. Families are being ripped apart now because there's no spiritual connection to God. People are making promises. They get married, and after, you know, a couple months, oh, I'm unhappy, and they ditch it. And so there's no – people aren't getting married. A bunch of single moms raising kids, and the kids aren't raised by mom. They're raised by daycare, and they're being – put values that aren't really good. And I have to say, just without God, you just lose so much. Like, I'm at a much happier place than without God. I would be so dark. I'd be so angry. You wouldn't want to be around me. I'd just be a bad, bad person. So I think even short term, the parachute is not only good, it's like, it just keeps me a better person.
I just wanted to mention that Don is off mute now. Don, you can talk if you want. His smartphone faded into the galaxy again. Okay, we'll continue the conversation. I agree with part of that, John, but as I discussed earlier, sometimes things come unexpectedly at us, and we can't predict how people are going to act or how things will happen.
I'm back from the galaxy.
Okay, Galaxy Don from Uber Space, do you want to weigh in on this conversation?
Well, in a way, there's a whole hell of a lot of conversation that just went on. Our guest, he was mentioning a few things. I didn't get his name. I'm sorry, but for the most part, he was mentioning a few
things.
He's
still on the air. What's your name?
My name is Mike.
Mike.
Okay, I noticed you're from the Minneapolis area.
Yes, ma'am.
We're broadcasting from Duluthville, Los Angeles.
Oh, wow, nice.
We had 3 inches of snow up here tonight. Go ahead, Don.
Okay, well, I thought the analogy was interesting. Let me put it like that. I didn't necessarily agree with the conclusion, because the guy who's a Christian, he was given the parachute to someone else. That would have been just normal. So I don't know if the conclusion was, if there was a conclusion, Mike, but I didn't see it. I didn't see it that way anyway. But for the most part, this is, you know, John is right when you say that you make your vows to God. If you believe in God, if you don't, you know, do like I did with my vows. I made sure that I left out the fidelity part of it, because I needed that was at that time that wasn't happening forever and ever. But because of those understandings, whatever fidelities that I've had have been somewhat forgiven, or at least not acknowledged as part of the
infidelities.
Common. Fidelities, infidelities, same damn thing. So bottom line is that we're trying to, you know, when you make a vow under God, you have to be very specific about the verbiage and what you want him to have for you. What do you want him to do for you and do for him? So those are the things that you have to be very, very cognizant about when you make your vows And it sounds like John was having a good time. I don't know if the vows were...
No, John was very devoted. And to me, it sounds like he's angry because his wife changed his mind, her mind. And
right.
I mean, John, let me just tell you something. I got married at 23, and I had been in the church since I was age 4, but I only spent 2 weeks out of the 6-month engagement with my husband because he was in Norfolk, Virginia in the Navy, and we knew each other in college, and we decided to get married. And then 6 months later, I set the date, but I only spent 2 weeks with him in that whole time. And I didn't fully know what I was doing, but, I mean, if you're a really strict husband and going to hold your wife accountable till the day of her death, that's not really your job. It's God's job to hold Debbie accountable for what she did or did not do. And she might have disappointed you, but it's over, and it's a very sad thing. But in my case, we had a child that died, and we couldn't cope with it afterwards. Craig didn't have the emotional capacity, and I didn't have, I couldn't deal with his emotional distance, so the marriage crumbled.
Well, that's your situation, so, you know, I won't judge you, but all I can say is what circumstance would you ditch Lolo? Or if your child was born and was living, at what level would you ditch him or her? You would say, at no level. It's like, there's no limit to my love. Well, why can't we extend that to our marriage partner? I mean, that's the vow. It's like, no matter what, we work through it. I think people make up excuses like, oh, I was emotionally disconnected. He was not available for me, this or that. It's like, you know what? You just make it work. And that's what I did. My wife cheated on me, and I said, you know what, we'll work through it. And she got to a point where, when we did, and down the line, she got to a point where she just wanted to be free and do her thing. And that's okay. It was like, you know, at that point, we decided to move different directions, and it's okay. It's, you know, life just happens, and you have to go from there. I'm just saying that people need to be serious about their commitment, and if not, then fine, have a casual relationship and live your life. But those are the consequences.
Well, I think in some
society cases,
like, you and Debbie were really emotionally connected and you dated for 3.5 years. I knew Craig in college and we both loved history and he liked Abraham Lincoln and we liked all those kind of intellectual things. But after being married for a couple of weeks, I realized that our emotional connection was either going to have to be developed or it had a long way to go because we didn't have that instant connection like some married couples do. So in some ways it might have been an impulsive mistake, but we were married 10 years.
Yeah, I think though it helps. Yes, it's smart to date and courtship and, you know, have a season or so, you know, a year, a couple of years, whatever. Just get to know people. But, you know, old school, historically, marriages were arranged, and actually they have better marriage statistics than those who, when we make our own decisions, like our parents actually make better decisions because the first 3 months, your brain doesn't work when you're dating someone. It chemically, you're so infatuated. You could be marrying Hitler, and you would think it's the greatest person in the world. I've dated people several times. Like the first 3 months, they think I am Jesus. I mean, they would jump off a bridge for me. And a couple of years later, they're like, you know, I fell out of love. So I think in your case, I thought I had worked it out 3.5 years. I thought we had everything worked out. Well, the first 6 months you're together with this person, you find out I didn't know anything, you know. It's like you have a fight, and you don't leave. It's like this person is sleeping in my bed tonight, and I have to, you know, I'm not going home. It's like I thought we worked all this crap out. It's like we don't work anything out. It's like this is all new. So I think you just have
to. Well, one advantage to marrying someone in the Navy is they might not be in your bed that night. He might have gone on a 6-month tour the next day.
You know, I think, well, those are hard relationships, you know, because people, you know, without, it's like they say absence makes the heart grow fonder. It's like, no, absence makes the heart wander. But I do think you can make a decision, you know, like being a Christian, you know, Jesus walked up to people and said, follow me. And it's like, oh, and they left. They dropped their lives. They just left. I think you can meet someone, and sometimes it's luck, but, you know, you hear people in high school, they get married, or they meet someone, and they're married for 50 years. I think you just have to, it's a mindset. I'm just going to work through it, and, you know, it helps to have attraction, it helps to have chemistry, but it's a commitment to me. I just think you make your decision, you make it work, and people don't have that resolution, and without that, it's just very easy. I'm surprised, though, Don. You worked out your deal. Like you made your own vows. That's incredible.
He didn't make his own vows. He crossed his fingers at the altar.
Really?
Don, don't embarrass us in front of the Minneapolis guests. I do kind of want to move away from marriage for a minute because it's an uncomfortable subject. Can we get more deeper into what's going on into the world?
Oh,
beyond
yeah.
Beyond my infidelity to Donald Trump?
Well, I'm still a romantic. I think marriage is beautiful. I tell people, you know, do it at least once, yeah, but just don't keep, you know, getting married 50 gazillion times. But some people, they need practice. I'm a firm believer in
well,
love.
I'm gonna call you on your own BS because Stacy from SOS said that you were too afraid to get remarried, and your excuse about not being able to afford to have a wife in the West Los Angeles district, she thought that was an excuse.
You know, it could be. I don't know. I'm a realist. I think after I've dated a few people and. Bottom line is, you know, I'm a single kind of guy. You know, it's like I can't make a woman happy. And I kind of like
you know?
What I do.
How do you know?
Women tell me that. Because women tell me that. I've dated two or three very seriously. And at the end of two or three years, I'm good for about 3 years. And then they suddenly go, they fall out of love. It's like, I don't know. They don't feel it anymore. It's I'm the same
Maybe
guy.
It's because they have to wait 6 years to have sex.
No.
Okay.
I
well, anyways,
it's my
Don.
Throat.
You were
you
on
know,
mute for a second. I'm not sure why. Are you back with us, Don?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. I was talking earlier tonight about the New World Order, you know. And do you guys think that anything's really changed in the last 30 years, like? Russia is still a territorial expansionist. They still want their fingers in the pie on some level on what's going on in the Mideast. They controlled Azerbaijan for years, as I've mentioned on the show. My friend Jehun that I talked to from Tajikistan yesterday, he said that Russia won't give up Syria because they basically just want that geopolitical stronghold in that area. It has nothing to do with the number of deaths by women and children. They just see it as a geopolitical casualty or advantage. So I'm not trying to completely change the subject, however I might be. But I want to read another a clip out of the Henry Kissinger book, Diplomacy.
Oh, my God.
He was just give me a short paragraph. Yeah, Henry Kissinger to some people is corrupt. Because he helped overthrow the Chilean government in 73. But he was, as a political science and a writer, he was brilliant. At this writing, the prospects for democracy in Russia are yet uncertain, nor is it clear that even a democratic Russia will conduct policies conducive to international stability. Throughout the dramatic history, Russia has marched by quite a different drummer than the rest of the Western world. It never had an autonomous church. It missed the Reformation and the Enlightenment, the Age of Discovery and the modern market economics. So all that stuff they missed, including the Enlightenment and the Age of Discovery. Leaders with democratic experience are in short supply. Almost all of Russia's leaders, as well as those in the new republics, held high office under communism, and its commitment to pluralism was not their first instinct. It may not prove to be their last. Now, pluralism is opportunity for many, you know, like an upward mobility type government system. So why do you guys think that the national news keeps elevating this twisted potential relationship between Trump and Putin? Like, that's the only decks on the cards of the table. Does anyone have a comment?
It's easy. Number one, it's because the Democrats are still upset about the fact that they lost the election, and they're trying to use Trump's potential connection to Russia, which is total BS, as a way to try to justify why they lost. When in reality, the reason they lost simply has to do with the fact that Hillary Clinton was just not a good candidate, and that she was the one Democratic candidate
that Trump could beat. It wasn't Trump's decision to have a congressional hearing about it, and it was our government that discovered that there was ties. Pardon?
Well, there isn't ties. For example, we know it's on record now. If you actually, the original statement they made back in October, they said that it was an ambiguous statement, meaning that they weren't sure necessarily, but they were assuming that the one supplying all the information to WikiLeaks was coming from a Russian agent, or somehow the Russian government was involved. But it was total speculation. Even now, they're not totally sure. He came out again and said, we can't know conclusively, but we feel like most likely it may be. Which, that's just double talk for saying, I don't know for sure. I mean, that's all it is. I mean, how would you be able to, like, make that conclusively?
I do have a question for you directly. I just want to mention that I don't know how Obama engineered this probe into how Russia, our intellectual community discovered that Russia had a hand in this. Whether Obama ordered it or not, I don't know, but our U.S. Congress decided to do an investigation, and they had some hearings on the news this week. So separate from CNN. Like, CNN didn't call Congress and say, let's do an investigation. I mean, you can't the media is not in collusion with the government.
Yes, they are. I can show this easily. I just want to make one point. The way you know this is, for example, most of the general public isn't aware of this, but we've had hacking from China and several other nations for the last 6-7 years very aggressively that both the State Department, the CIA, and the FBI were fully aware of. We didn't hear the media making a big deal about it. We didn't hear anything about congressional hearings. But now, come forward to today, after the election, now all of a sudden Obama and the Democrats are making a big deal about this. And now they're talking about congressional hearings. Why? Because it's a political ploy, because the liberals are in a hissy fit, because they lost to the one guy that they were comparing to Hitler. And so the embarrassment of losing to Trump is why they got to prop up this whole Russian narrative when it's a total BS narrative. Because if it was true, why didn't they do it 3 years ago with China, when China was hacking our State Department over and over again? But now it's the Russian thing's a big deal? Come on, guys. You got to know BS when you see it. Come on.
China,
can I interject too?
From different levels of our federal government, but it didn't influence an election. It was only stuff that they were trying to find out. I'm going to look on the internet to see if China received retribution for that. Go ahead, John.
Well, here's a question, too, to follow up to that, because I know whatever I say, Jane is going to get very upset because she's a very pro-Hillary, very pro-Obama, and she's not very conservative. But was the fact that the Russians hacked things, is that the issue? Or is the issue that they hacked things that Hillary said and put in emails? I mean, in other words, she did the crime. They're just exposing it. So who really cares who exposed it?
Okay, first of all, speak only for yourself, not what my feelings are. And second of all, the only crime, if you want to describe it that way, is that she mismanaged top security emails. I wouldn't call it a crime, technically.
What about the things she said politically? For example, when she gave that private speech, several private speeches, where one, she talked about having a public and private position. Another one where she gave an email talking about how most of their supporters are poor, are dumb, or ignorant, especially blacks and young people who are living in their quote-unquote mother's basements, which is why they're, quote, leading to the left. I mean, we can look at all kinds of things. All the stuff that came out tarnished her image so badly that it gave Donald Trump, who's supposed to be the worst candidate ever, remember? That's why he won. I mean, the fact that she lost to this guy is the most embarrassing defeat in the history of probably the presidential politics, probably since, I don't know, Howard Taft? I mean, what are we talking about? So I'm sorry, I know you're a Hillary supporter, but at the end of the day, she lost to Donald Trump, man. She should no longer be allowed to show her face in public anymore. She's done. It's over.
I don't think she should have to hide her face in public just because she lost a public election. But the Chinese breach of our federal government only occurred at the Office of Personnel Management, in which they reviewed background checks for federal employees. And there's not much retribution the United States government can take against that. All they can do is say, why did you do it, China? It's not like they can bust anybody or take them to federal court unless they're living in our country. So that's a lot different than a publicly held election.
Okay, ask yourself this question. How did Russia actually influence the result of the election? How?
I'm not sure personally if they did. All I know is that they hacked the DNC and exposed things that the DNC was doing strategically and some bad choices of words they use. Like they use the expression tossing up the salad bowl or something like that for Latinos. So
okay. So let me ask you this then. Which was worse? Which one was worse?
Poorly chosen words and emails between Democratic DNC leaders.
Okay, so which one was worse, the WikiLeaks?
Who should have already resigned anyway.
Yeah, but that was months before the election. What was actually worse, the WikiLeaks or James Comey coming out about a week before
the
election and announcing it?
Just a minute, please. Well, it must be John because I muted Don for a second. John, I'm going to mute you for 30 seconds because you're rustling papers. All I know is, I'll tell you what influenced the election. A mass of low-information voters from southern states who don't know toilet paper from paper towels decided to go to the polling place and vote for the Donald because they think he's patriotic.
But
and
well,
all
see,
the
that's a false statement by you to say that, because the southern states
always
vote
right
anyway.
Well, I'm just saying
right
a lot
anyway.
Of low-information voters voted for Donald because all he
okay,
did is
so,
recite five
ma'am.
Lines during the whole election. And,
well,
and they thought that
one,
was a winning
one, that's not
combination.
True, but hold on. The reason he won is because he won the Rust Belt, did he not? It's because he won Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, and Iowa, state, and Wisconsin
that's
states that she was supposedly
true, but
leading.
He also swept the South. And
well,
Hillary
Republicans
should have taken North Carolina. It's Don's turn to talk.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
John, you're back off mute, but go ahead, Don.
Wow. Oh, my fucking God. You guys. All right. First of all, Mike, you are correct. Jane, you are partially correct. This is a rural win, and for the most part, the hacks occurred probably in North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and possibly Minnesota. So those were the hacks. And they're not necessarily hacks, but they're voting machine improprieties that occur with double voting, triple voting, things like that across state borders.
I think you meant Wisconsin, not Minnesota.
Wisconsin. Yes. And
Minnesota had no voting glitches.
Okay, well, that's what Minnesota says. But they all went to Wisconsin to vote three times. under other names. But for the most part, the hacks are, like Mike was saying, more or less, they're not necessarily Russian emanated. They were probably DNC people who just, who knows if they either had a vendetta against Hillary or if they might have just wanted to do it just for shits and giggles, because that's what most computer geeks do. The only reason that they're having these hacks is because they what is because they is because that's what they do. They love it. That's fun to hack something, and if something comes of it, then that would so be it. Assange just did mention that the Russians didn't have any the connection didn't have any relevance, and it was not. You know, this is Hillary. Hillary did not. You know, as Mike mentioned, did not. Campaign in the right places. She was just depending on the urban areas to pull her through, and she did not go down to, you know, goat shit, Mississippi or something like that. And Donald Trump was right there eating goat shit. So, you know, and I had, as I said, I have no real problem.
You see, again, my friend John, I'm assuming you're a liberal, right?
It's Don.
Or Don.
I do want to mention... I want to mention one thing, Mike, before you jump in again. First of all, America is, we're divided by class warfare. And what I meant by intellectual strongholds in places like New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle is that people who are educated would never vote for Donald Trump because not because they just dislike his politics, but he has absolutely no command of the federal government, its function, and its purpose. So,
but
what are you going to argue with me?
Okay,
well,
so, ma'am,
let's
actually look at the numbers before you say that. Hold on. She made a point that she said no college-educated person would vote for him. So let's actually look at the data. Okay,
I didn't say college-educated. I said intellectually aware, meaning someone who has conception of social trends, social movements, and what's happened in this country in the last 40 years?
Okay, so ma'am, hold on. Let's break it down for her. So let's say this, okay. So if someone who's intellectually aware, by your words, right? If someone who's intellectually aware believes in lower taxes, less regulation, from an economic standpoint, that that's more beneficial to the economy. So you're saying that they have to reject that, and they have to accept the liberal ideal of increasing taxes and increasing regulation on our economy, that that's a better solution for making the economy work, right? That's what you're telling me?
There, as John and I have stated on the show many times, and he stated that a lot of people who align with traditional Republican ideology may have ended up in Donald Trump's camp, or they might have voted for someone else like Ted Cruz. So sometimes they overlooked his character defects, as we say in our 12-step meetings, and they might have voted for Trump on the basis that he was the Republican Party representative.
Of course.
Well, so
you can't vote on character in this election when you had two flawed character people. I mean, Hillary Clinton was a known liar. So it's like you had two people who are flawed. So at the end of the day, all we had to base it on was political ideology and their economic plans. And that's it. When you compare
well,
the two,
I am loyal to
anyone
the Clintons
with common sense can see that.
I had a personal loyalty to the Clintons going back to 1992. There's reasons for it. I was 32 years old at the time that he won, and there's reasons for it. I also worked on two of his campaigns, and I was a paid campaign finance staff manager for a Minnesota senator, Al Franken. So I'm sorry I'm entrenched in the Democratic Party. Sue me.
Well, to follow up, though, to what was stated earlier, you're saying, if I get this right, that if you're a very smarter, highly educated person, you really think that the breakdown of American family is great for the country, that transgender rights, that's the wave of the future. Mutilate your body. Like, let's transgender your pet, because then they'll be happy. They'll figure themselves out. you'll get to a chemical society where big government prints more money that we can't account for. We just triple the deficit. That's going to make things better. And kids are going to be raised not by their parents, but by single moms who divorce and just go to a socialist system of going to government to get
that's
money and benefits.
That's a bunch of BS, John.
No,
do you think I had
BS.
A choice about Lauren's dad going back to Africa?
Well, you made some choices there because you didn't know who the father was. You went after the wrong guy for 8 years until you found out he wasn't the dad when you ordered a
paternity
test.
It wasn't 8 years.
So,
it was 3 years.
Well, yeah, but he was...
Well, guys, let's not make this personal. I mean, we're just talking politics. You don't have to get into each other's personal
business. And that actually wasn't fully true. He distorted that, and... Anyways, you know, I was going to make a joke. I'm not playing his music anymore. I'll play the Russian national anthem.
Oh, my God. That's a little much, don't you think? Come on.
Well, you know,
I mean, look,
neither Don or John has pitched in for the show. So, Don, why don't you carry on this conversation? I have to call John back.
All right. Well, bottom line is that... there shouldn't be a reason to have to call John back. But, I don't even know what it is that you guys are trying to get at. So what? Donald Trump won. It could be good for some people. Yes, Donald Trump is a Nazi. So the bottom line is that we know what we've got.
But he's not a Nazi, though. Like, don't you notice how every election that the Democrats – always portray the Republican candidate as a racist, a Nazi, a misogynist.
No.
It's every guy. It doesn't matter who any Republican candidate for the next 50 years is going to be labeled that. That's just how it is.
No. The other candidates weren't.
They would have. They would have done it. They did it to Mitt Romney. They made Mitt Romney look like the worst person since Mussolini. And Mitt Romney was probably, compared to Trump, was probably the most tamest candidate we've ever had.
Okay,
him, they did that.
Well, the thing is that we work with, this is a democracy. This is a Republican, Federalist Republic. So we're trying to work with everybody. And the thing is about Donald Trump is that, first of all, his dad was, his grandfather helped with the SS. Supplying it, so it was. It's in his blood, but he is filling his cabinet with, and this is what worries me, with KKK members, and then he's wooing Mitt Romney.
That's a false statement, man. Look, you're talking about Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, right?
No.
KKK reference.
Way more.
Who? Okay, well, name him. Who are you talking about?
The entire cabinet, okay?
Oh, now it's the entire cabinet where former KKK members, as you're saying?
I didn't say former, but for the most part, there are some affinities there for some of them, quite a few of them.
Okay, Ken, okay,
then,
name one and then show an example of where that's there, because I'm familiar with most of these people, so I want to know where you're making this assumption that they're affiliated with the KKK. I mean, what are you basing that off of?
All right, we'll just go with Sessions and leave it at that. But bottom line.
Okay, so hold on. Let's stop that. Let's deal with that. So Sessions, when he was in Alabama, actually fought several civil rights cases against the KKK, and even filed a civil lawsuit that was large. It was almost like $60 million against a particular KKK leader in Alabama, and so. Again, aside from that, the fact that that's on record, now you made a broader statement, which I'm sure you heard from somebody else, who said Trump's cabinet is full of KKK members, right? And so you're repeating what someone else told you. You didn't actually check out the background of any of these people.
Okay.
I don't see where the evidence would be there to support your statement.
That's fine. No, okay, I'll retract the statement. But anyway, he's looking for Mitt Romney's Mormons because they are the biggest killers of the Indians in American history. So if he has those three, I would have to say militarized organizations, the cabinet, along with his Supreme Court nominees, which we will soon see if they have any of those affinities also, we are going to have a very racist government. However, it's everyone's opportunity. This is there are always opportunities when things arise, and this is everyone's opportunity to speak up and ask for what they want. Mainly because there are going to be some factions in this new government that will be listening to new ideas, trying to formulate what the future is going to be for their political for each political party. And so we're looking at a future at least 2 years, 4 years, where we'll be able to make some hay, we'll make some headway into whatever processes that we want to bring about, because this is the time with a new regime and they need input from the populace. And this is the ideal time. Now, in terms of the appointees being KKK members, I'm not sure about all the names, but reason for backlash from both Democrats and Republicans is because they do have the lady who is, she was just appointed from Department of Education, where she has no interest in education.
Let's deal with that. You're talking about the ball from, she's from Michigan. What her issue with her is that she's supporting charter schools and the idea that parents should have school choice. What does that mean? For example, the Democrats want the current situation where if you, for example, let's say you have you have children and you live in the inner city. Currently, in order to get, you'd be forced to have to send your children to that whatever public school, whatever district you're in. Now, Dubois and many Republicans are advocating for school choice where if you have a child, you can choose to take your child to whether it be a charter school, private school, religious school, whatever public school you choose to. And the federal dollars that would be allocated to cover your child, if they went to a public school, now they could take that same federal money and it would cover their tuition to go to any school they choose to go to. So, for example, you could take your child to a private school, and the public federal money that would have went to the public school to pay for your child, that percentage would cover their private tuition. So now, as a parent, you have the freedom to choose whatever school you want your children to go to. That's the issue with her. Now, the Democrats don't want that. Why? Because the Democrats support the teachers union. And the teachers union want to make sure that kids in the inner city have to still go to public schools in the inner city, no matter how bad the school is, because they want that federal money allocated to that student to still come to their school. See, that's right. The game being played. But most people, they're not aware of these issues. So what they hear is they hear what the media, the liberal media, news media, which is the majority of the news stations, tell them. And so the majority of the news stations, with the exception of Fox, all the rest of them are very liberal, very pro-Democrat. So they give you the Democrat position, and they're not going to show you both sides of the argument, right? And so most people, they're not even aware of this fact. They don't even know this issue about education. They don't realize that it would benefit them. Like, I would love to have school choice for my children. I don't want to be forced out to make my kids go to a bad public school just because I live in that district. That's terrible. I want to have the freedom to say I can take my kid to any school, and the federal money that public school would have got for my child, whether it be $11,000 or $14,000 a year, that money, instead of going to that public school, I could use that to pay for my child's tuition at a good private school or at a good charter school, whatever. I mean, come on, man. That's common sense.
Can I interrupt for a second?
But it's not the way.
Actually, I did support George W. Bush with his No Child Left Behind, because I ended up becoming a tutor in Los Angeles for a lot of kids that were well-served under that No Child Left Behind. They got individual tutoring for subjects they were weak in. So just because I'm a Democrat doesn't mean that I didn't support certain programs.
Well,
we were talking about Trump's...
Well, I know you're talking about charter schools, and I'm an advocate of free choice for charter schools, too.
Charter schools.
Because I'm a teacher.
The charter schools.
It's not only charter schools. The thing applies to charter private schools. It applies to religious schools. It applies to other public schools, let's say in the suburbs. It applies to any school of your choice. That's the point of it. Meaning, as a parent, You're not limited to the district that you live in. You can go.
But
you can go anywhere.
I live in Nevada, and we are proposing the most liberal voucher system that's ever been. So, for the most part, the process is being stomped on. Public schools are public schools, period. We're supposed to have equal access for everyone. The problem is that the talk about the greedy. I'll mention the greedy because I'm not sure about Mike yet. But for the most part, the greedy are taking advantage of everything. They're sucking the blood out of our public school monies, and we're in the process of
who are the greedy? You're saying that people are reducing the education budgets that you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about they're sucking all the. They don't care about education. They only care about the monies that are generated by education. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. So, sir, are you aware of the fact that America spends more on education per student than any other country? It's not even close.
And yet, with that, we
rank around in the 20s from an education standpoint as far as our students.
Because of the business model.
Okay. So let me ask you this. Do you know why China and India rank in the top of the world and why America doesn't? Do you have any idea?
In terms of what? In education?
As far as their students' performance.
That's because their students are in school 9 to 10 hours a day.
That's not why, sir.
No,
because most American students are in school almost 8 hours a day anyway. That's not why. I can tell you why. It's really easy. Most Americans don't even know why. It's unbelievable. It's called they don't have compulsory education. And compulsory education is in America where, for example, you have to go to school, and regardless of your performance, you can stay in school no matter how you perform. In China and India, they have a performance required education, meaning by that if you don't reach a certain test score every year, you're no longer allowed to go to school anymore. So they make their schools competitive, and you have to earn your right to stay in the school. And so because of that, they have a high standard of academics, and even though they don't even spend like 5% of what we spend on education, their students oftentimes are in schools where they're sitting on a dirt floor where they have no notebooks, no pencils, no paper. All they have is the one chalkboard that the teacher uses, and they have to memorize oftentimes mentally. They can't even take notes. And they still outdo our American students tremendously. Why? Because they have a culture that demands academic excellence, and they have competitive schools where if you don't earn your way into that school by grading at least 85% or better on test scores, you're no longer allowed to stay in school. You're forced to have to leave. But they don't do that in America. That's why America is becoming uncompetitive. America's answer is we need to invest more money, throw more money at the problem. That's what Americans think.
That's what I was going to say. In essence, for the most part, we've lost our compulsory educational model. And I'm a big proponent of having mandatory sets of classes for all students.
Have compulsory education. I'm saying China and India do not. That's what I'm arguing, is that because they don't make school mandatory, you have to earn the right to stay in school by grading a certain percentage. That's why their students are better than ours, because they're forced to be competitive. American students, they don't have to compete to stay in school. You can go to school even if you're a D or an F student, you can still stay in school. They're not going to kick you out.
Right.
What are you talking about? That's
no,
the problem.
No, they're not. Okay, well, maybe I did mistake what you said. But for the most part, I do like the compulsory, mandatory classes. And that's only because we need to learn the rudiments. But all those, the other countries, their students learn foreign languages. They're much more creative. They've got that capability of seeing the world, whereas we just tell bits and pieces. And Common Core, I work with the Republicans for the repeal of Common Core and things like that. So, I don't like the way that the origination of Common Core was simply investment bankers out of Saudi Arabia and the UK. So they had no idea, no concern about education. They're just looking for the test scores, the training tools. Those are all extremely lucrative businesses. And that's what education has become in America, and that's why we've dropped to 34th in the world. But in a lot of ways,
no, sir, come on now. It has nothing to do with the business model, sir. It has to do with the American culture. The American culture compared to other cultures are not the same. That's my point.
They don't force their kids to learn.
Like, I don't know what it was like for you growing up. Like, my family immigrated here. And they came from an outside perspective, and they were demanding when it came to education. I mean, our free time, my dad would force us to write out the entire Bible, and he would judge our handwriting to the point where he would see how much pressure we applied to the page. He was that strict. And my other friends growing up, for example, like I'm African, right? My other friends that were African American, when I would go to see what they were doing, their parents didn't even care. Their parents could care less what they did. Half the time, they didn't even go to school, and they never even got a word from their parents. And what I realized is that in America, a lot of American parents, they don't care about education. They don't take it that serious, and they could care less what their kids do. And that's why our schools are embarrassing.
We're at the 90-minute mark, and I have to handle some business with Don individually. So I'm going to have to let you off the hook now. Would you like to make a conclusion?
Go ahead, Mike.
No, you can make your conclusion,
but I got some company business to handle with Don immediately. That can't wait.
Don, no. Okay. All right. Well,
so, Don, don't hang up. I have to talk to you.
Okay.
Well, thanks for joining us. Okay, good night. Don?
Yeah.
I literally can't handle what John did tonight. I just paid $40 for Blog Talk Radio, and if I hadn't done that, I would cut the show off permanently.
Okay, so I don't know what John did. I must have missed something. I was trying to listen to everything that was going on, but I must have missed something.
He basically brought up a part of my life that's nobody's business.
Okay.
And if you didn't hear it, I'm not going to repeat it.
Don't repeat it.
I'll call you back on your land phone. I'm going
to
end the show.
There you go. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Good night.
Good night.